Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, September 9th, welcome, 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 friends, to the show. I am Cherry Gregg.
And I am Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
So, Avi, if you're traveling around Philadelphia these days, the streets and the sidewalks, it's like a game of Frogger. If you're trying to cross the street, you may have to duck or dodge people on bikes, skateboards, e-scooters, e-bikes, cars, babies in strollers, and it can get dangerous. And to top it all off, another cyclist was killed in a hit and run in Fairmount Park a week ago today. His name was Harry Fenton, and he was actually a bike safety advocate. And all of this has sparked a conversation in the city, online, all about bike and pedestrian safety, because while overall fatalities have been trending down this year, people walking and biking are still bearing a larger share of the loss. And so today on Studio 2, we're going to get practical. We'll do a check-in on cyclist, pedestrian, other non-car vehicle safety. And we will also look at an effort to pass a law to regulate some of these electric vehicles. And so we'd love for you to join the conversation. Our question of the day is this: in a time when e-bikes, scooters, bikes, and pedestrians share the streets, how can we create a safer city? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you know what to do. Share this video, but also leave the comments in the chat.
Let me add, cars are also sharing those streets.
Yes.
So in a time when scooters, bikes, pedestrians, and cars are sharing the streets, how do we create a safer city? Again, the number is 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. Shall we first investigate a trio of local news stories?
Absolutely. Jared, jump in, Avi.
All right. So Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro was in West Philadelphia yesterday for the opening of a youth education center funded by Tiger Woods. And apparently sports was on the mind, because at a press gaggle, Shapiro said the Trump administration's economic policies are driving higher costs that will make it harder for families to afford upcoming big events in Philly, such as the MLB All-Star Game, the FIFA Men's World Cup, both of those next summer. Shapiro also said at this availability that Trump's policies are depressing tourism ahead of the big celebrations coming our way in 2026. The number of international travelers is down year over year, about 4%.
President Donald Trump was elected because people wanted him to lower prices and make the economy better, but prices are still high. Some are going up thanks to tariffs, unemployment up, job prospects down. So all of this will impact whether or not people across the country can travel to Philadelphia. As for the immigration stuff, I mean, Shapiro may have a point. I mean, whether or not, you know, foreign tourists want to come here, but we'll still have to see. It's a long way away for FIFA 2026, although it's getting closer.
FIFA 2026. FIFA. You're going to learn that.
You know what? Like, did I just reveal
we're
that?
We're all about to learn
soccer
over the next year. We're all going to become very fluent in soccer.
I got to get better, y'all.
Over the
guys.
Next year. But
Thank
by the
you.
Way, if you are interested in
FIFA,
going to a FIFA World Cup game next summer, there are six of them here in Philadelphia, and the first batch of tickets goes on sale tomorrow.
Oh.
And it's an extremely complicated process. So if you're interested, Nick Kariuki for Billy Penn wrote a whole guide on how to potentially try to get tickets. Like I said, one of the most befuddling ticket allocation processes I've ever come across in my life. So check that out, BillyPenn.com.
I do wonder how much those tickets are going to cost.
A lot.
A lot. Oh, you going to try to go?
I am going to try to go. But I have I'm not going to say it out loud, but there's a set price in my head I will not go above.
Okay. All right. We'll see. We'll see. All right. Second story. The three Pennsylvania Supreme Court justices that are up for a retention vote this November, they sat down for a fireside chat at Central High School last night. The three justices are Christine Donahue, Kevin Dougherty, and David Wecht. And all three ran as Democrats in 2015. And I had the honor of moderating the discussion with them. The whole purpose was to allow the public to get to know the justices, understand their temperament, and get a view on how they see the state's highest court and their role on the court. By the way, I have to shout out a committee of 70 and the Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts that put this forum together. The big standout moments, Avi, were the justices sort of discussing how they ran as Democrats, because that's what the political process in Pennsylvania requires. But once they put on that black robe, they said all political affiliations, their personal beliefs sort of go out the door and they become, you know, just standard bearers of the law, very apolitical bodies. They also talked about how they spar with one another over decisions and how they have a lot of collegiality in the court. They eat dinner. All seven justices eat dinner together fairly often, you know, and just to get to know each other. And they also pulled back the curtain on how the sausage is made and how they reach a decision. So very interesting conversation, a rare opportunity to see the judges, because unless it's an actual election or retention year, they're not allowed to talk in this kind of way. And so you don't see them, you know, all on a stage together. And so WHYY will be broadcasting this conversation closer to the election.
Nice. I look forward to that. Yeah, great that you guys were able to put that event together. The politics of this are pretty interesting, Cherry.
Yeah.
The Republicans are really organizing around the idea of rejecting these three judges together, which could tip the balance of the court. And I wonder if that'll make their job a little easier, because you can say, look, you can get rid of all these Democrats in one fell swoop. Mm-hmm. Typically, historically, very difficult to get a no vote on a retention case.
And by the way, on the ballot, you'll see their three names. There won't be a party affiliation. And all voters have to do is vote yes or no.
And we know people like to hit yes.
Yeah.
When there's like a yes, no question on a ballot. I will say it's happened one time, I believe.
Yeah.
In 20 years ago, there was a judge who you got a no on a retention vote. But it was an unusual set of circumstances. And I do want, I guess my question is sort of an open question of having three at once. Does that make it easier politically to you know, muster?
And I have to say one more thing. What's so interesting, Avi, is that, you know, 10 years ago, the court had all kinds of drama. They had lost a justice, a died. There had been this scandal.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was all kinds of stuff going on at the high court. This time it's been pretty quiet. You know, the court has sort of been doing their job for the past several years. You really haven't heard too much. They've had some big decisions, you know, especially with the funding of education. But and yet this is the target year. It just seems, you know, this is definitely, it's very political.
Yeah. But I would say one of the big decisions was around the congressional map.
Yes.
And that's the one
that
really
sparked a lot of
that's
drama.
That's a partisan, that gets people's partisan fervor going. And I think they're probably lucky, actually, that education case, I think, made it up to Commonwealth, but then was not appealed up to Supreme. So they never had to sort of put their stamp on that one way or the other. Mm-hmm. So I think they're probably maybe thankful for that right now. We'll see. But it's an interesting election. And like I said, historically, very tough to muster up enough no votes. But maybe this is the situation where Republicans feel like they can get it done.
Maybe.
Story number three, a story from the Inquirer that stopped us in our tracks and dropped us in our stomachs.
Uh-oh.
A pub in the Penn Sports section of South Philadelphia is turning heads with a drink called the Dirty Spicy Caesar Martini. It's a martini that tastes like a Caesar salad. The pub is called O'Jung's. The drink consists of vodka, dry vermouth, a splash of olive juice, half ounce each of homemade Caesar dressing, and buffalo sauce. Apparently, this
buffalo
is a trend.
Sauce? I'm sorry. I had missed that. Buffalo sauce?
Buffalo. That's the spicy part.
Okay.
Apparently, this is part of an online thing. It's always the influencers, right?
I'm sorry. I didn't realize.
It's
Go
always
ahead.
The
I'm
influencers.
Sorry.
The influencers apparently are talking about making these savory cocktails a thing, specifically like martinis that taste like a seafood boil. Or the Olive Garden salad.
I don't know.
Bar.
None of that sounds appetizing to me. When you said seafood boil and a martini, I don't know.
Yeah. It's just got a little seafood flavor in
I feel
there.
Like it's going to get you right in the back of the mouth. Go ahead.
What?
It's like, you know, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. I have nothing more to say. It's your turn. The floor is yours.
You
said on this show that you like any drink that ends in teeny.
I do.
So
now you put me to the test,
so
man.
So would you drink the Dirty Spicy Caesar Martini?
When I saw that picture, it looked a little thick to me. And looked a little
very thick.
And yeah. It was like some
extremely
flakes,
viscous.
Some flakes on top that was probably like Parmesan cheese. I don't know. Like, I guess, no, I would not drink that. I don't even like Caesar salad. So I'm putting that out
there.
Yeah,
that's fair.
But I did come up with one that I would drink.
A salad turned drink.
Yes.
Okay, hit me.
I love caprese salad, okay, which is, you know, tomatoes, mozzarella cheese, a little basil. And I could make a caprese martini. You know, you could add some tomato juice or tomato infused vodka. You could do that. You could have a skewer with a grape tomato, a little ball of mozzarella cheese, another grape tomato, and you could garnish it with some basil. I think that would be delicious. And even shake some salt on top.
I was out when you said it, but you talked me into it. I would drink that.
I think that would be really delicious.
I would drink that.
So how about you?
You ever had like a Thai style papaya salad?
No, but that sounds delicious.
Google it.
Yeah, I like papayas.
I could see that being translated into a drink. Maybe even a wedge salad, because bacon in a drink, that's kind of a thing now. Could that work?
I think that could work. Add a little salt, because I think salt works well with teenies.
For the record, by the way, I would try the dirty, spicy Caesar martini under the banner of you try everything once, twice if you like it.
You're so brave.
Really,
he's willing to put his stomach through anything. Iron gut.
I'm a coward in so many ways, but not when
Wolfman
it comes to
Aaron.
Eating. let's transition to our main topic today. In a time when e-bikes, scooters, bikes, pedestrians, and cars share the streets, how can we create a safer city here in Philadelphia? That's the topic today. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. Ooh, the comments are already pouring in. This should be interesting. Stay tuned. This is Studio 2. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. The pandemic changed how we travel in cities. Public transit ridership is down, but the use of e-bikes and e-scooters is up. So how should our cities change to meet the new reality?
That is a question of convenience. It's also a question of safety. Traffic deaths soared here in Philadelphia during the early days of the pandemic. Since then, they have dropped, but remained above pre-pandemic levels, according to the latest data. And just last week, a devoted cyclist and advocate was killed in a hit and run while biking in Fairmount Park.
Today on the show, safer streets. How do we bring them to fruition? On the show, we've got Jesse Amadio, organizer at Philly Bike Action. Jesse, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yes, and we also want to say hello to Alex Quistberg, associate research professor at Drexel University. Alex, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
And let's repeat our question today. Mm-hmm. In a time when e-bikes, scooters, bikes, pedestrians, and cars share the streets, how do we create a safer city? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. Would love to hear your suggestions. YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And Jesse, we wanted to start with you because over the past year plus since Mayor Sherrell Parker took office, there's been a big push for more cyclist safety. And so we want to do a check-in. Where are we? What have you seen change during the Parker administration?
Yeah, I think we're seeing a lot of good progress, I would say. I think it started out, it seemed a little rocky. As you mentioned, traffic fatalities were still like way higher than they had been before the pandemic. And the Dr. Barbara Fetus was killed in that crash on the Spruce Street painted bike lane. And that really, I think, resonated with the whole city and led to this sort of a bigger public outcry than usual about what people wanted to see and an action they wanted to see from their elected leaders. And I think that the Parker administration and Council President Johnson, like newly elected to the presidency, have made that kind of an issue. And they've said, you know what, we heard you. We're going to start taking this maybe more seriously than we had in the past. And from that, we've seen some new stuff. Like there's the red light cameras, automatic speed enforcement cameras, an increased investment by the city in the Vision Zero funding, which is the city's commitment to end traffic fatalities in the city of Philadelphia by now 2050.
Because the goalpost was originally under Kenny at 2030, but it got pushed back.
When Mayor Parker re-signed this commitment. They moved it to 2050, and they left the 2030 commitment to be addressing every mile of the city's high and drain network, which is this network of streets in our cities that represent the most dangerous streets. So this is the 12% of streets that cause 80% of the deaths and serious injuries. So these, we can look at them and say, wow, this is, these are the roads where the most people are being killed or getting seriously hurt. And that's where the administration has said, we're going to focus on these, and we're going to try to do something to improve each of those by 2030. And we'll unfortunately have to push off the goal of actually preventing traffic deaths to 2050.
And just remind folks quickly, Jesse, how does Philadelphia stack up compared to other, you know, major cities when it comes to the number of traffic fatalities per capita?
It's not great, if I'm honest. If you compare it to other like comparable cities like LA and New York, we're like multiple times more deaths. I don't have the number off the top of my head, but it's like at least three times or something like that. And part of that is reflected in the investment. Like if you look at New York City, they're investing approximately like $80 per resident into safe street infrastructure, whereas in Philadelphia, it's like a dollar per resident. Like, so they're putting a lot of money into fixing their streets, and they're seeing a lot of benefits from that. Whereas in Philadelphia, unfortunately, we're seeing way more crashes than our population would like have compared to other cities.
Yeah. And this is a show that I know a lot of people are going to be calling in. We're seeing the comments coming in. Stan says on YouTube, Facebook, I am a longtime Philly bike commuter. I alternate between an e-bike and a manual bike. Regulations for e-bikes, especially charging them, and bike behavior are needed, as is enforcement. And so I wanted to, you know, before we bring in a caller, Jesse, sort of talk about the proliferation of all the new devices. And I've seen this. I mean, 5 years ago, you didn't necessarily see so many e-bikes, but I walked out of WHYY and people were zipping by me on the sidewalk on these e-scooters. So tell me how things have sort of changed now that we have other devices, not just bikes and pedestrians and cars.
Well, it certainly is different. And when you have more things moving at different speeds, so there is the element of like less predictability, which is inherently slightly dangerous. But I definitely want to start by saying that all of these things that we might call micromobility, especially e-bikes, they are so important to where we should be going, like as a society that needs to reduce its car dependence, especially talking about Philadelphia, where we're frankly running out of room to store all of these personal vehicles on our historic streets. And now with like septic cuts and stuff like that, there's going to be even more people who will have to drive a car to get to their job. We need as many people as possible taking other forms of transportation, specifically micromobility, because they have reduced lower impacts on air quality, fossil fuel consumption, you know, and they just take up less space, right? So we want to encourage as many people as possible to choose micromobility or walking or mass transit as their first choice for getting around. And so the fact that there's more of these available is huge. And it is a big increase to accessibility. Like you have a lot of older folks who maybe don't feel comfortable driving anymore, but aren't strong enough to bike, you know, 5 miles to the store. An e-bike is huge for them. They can really open up a lot of possibilities for personal transportation.
So Alex Quisberg, how do we integrate these devices into the city safely, both for the people riding them and for pedestrians and anyone else out there? So what's the prescription, and what should be the regulatory framework for e-scooters, e-bikes, et cetera?
I think that's a great and difficult question. lots of cities globally are dealing with this question, and many of them have taken different approaches. Some of them have focused on, you know, regulating the speed or what kind of areas of the road they can use, if they can share the bike lanes or not. There's things like that the different cities are doing. And I think, you know, we want to balance, you know, people being able to get where they want to go, how they, you know, want to get there, while at the same time maintaining safety for everybody, including the users of these new types of transportation, because, you know, their number of injuries and deaths from them has increased substantially since they've, you know, emerged on the scene. So I think, you know, we need to consider, like, what kinds of, you know, laws will permit people to still use them while keeping everyone safe. And it's not just the laws. We need also probably have more space for people to use these, because if we have, you know, traditional mechanical cyclists in a bike lane, we have an e-bike, you know, especially if you get some of the heavier ones, you know, that's a bad mix, you know, for safety. And, you know, for those who do bike, you know, bike lanes often aren't very spacious for passing people or things like that. These people go, you know, much faster typically because, you know, that's what the e-bike does for you, right? So I think having more options for, like, where they can travel is going to help a lot in alleviating some of those safety issues if we can think about that and reconsider, like, how we can reconfigure streets to accommodate and manage this because we can't
just... Can you
just,
give us an example of how it might work? I mean, is it sort of like two different bike lanes, one for one speed, one for the other? Is it designated streets for different types of... I mean, give me some sense of what could be out there.
It could be either of those or other options. I mean, like, I think even just widening the bike lane so there's more space to comfortably pass people without, you know, going into vehicle traffic would help a lot with that. You know, like, our bike lanes are usually, like, you know, like 1 yard, 1.5 yards wide. I don't want to say meters, but yards wide. And so, you know, that's not a lot of space for passing someone. And so even widening those could be a first important step. You know, creating separate infrastructure for them is another option. It's more difficult, but it's something that we could consider. You know, some cities have created that space for those users. So those are, you know, definitely some options.
Yeah. And so we now want to bring in a lawmaker who can walk us through some of the legal challenges that some of these e-vehicles have posed. Recently, the death of a 12-year-old on an e-scooter in Delaware County led some legislators to consider how scooters and bikes need to be regulated. And so joining us now to talk about legal regulations is State Senator Tim Carney, who represents parts of Delaware County. Senator Carney, welcome to Studio 2.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having us.
And so we want to talk about Abby's Law. First of all, what's your understanding about where regulations stand when it comes to these e-vehicles?
Well, they're kind of all over the place. I mean, the scooters are not covered under the motor vehicle code. Therefore, the letter of the law right now is that they're not allowed to be used on public streets. Different municipalities, obviously that's not what's happening now. Different municipalities are coming up with their own regulations around, and we've seen Ridley Township, for example, in Delaware County, which is banning them. I think Havertown just passed a regulation that basically required helmets for people up to age 16, I think. So, you know, there's a lot of confusion about what's legal, what's not legal, what's allowed and what's not allowed. And we're hoping, I mean, one of the aim behind the Abby's Law is to sort of get a standard set of regulations to work against, I mean, for municipalities.
And what do you think the standard should be, Senator Carney? And what would be the effect of that standard in your view?
Well, what we're seeing is that people are using, kids in particular, are using these scooters on the streets, and they can go pretty quickly on them. And we've seen, obviously, we had two accidents in Delaware County that were quite serious. One, of course, the one you described with Abby, but also there was another one that happened in Springfield that also involved two people riding on one of these things as opposed to one. We just want to make sure that there's common sense stuff that we can do. Abby's Law, the way it is right now, and it's definitely a work in progress, but Abby's Law, the way it's written right now, would be anybody would be, you couldn't operate them on public streets if you were under 16. And everybody between 16 and 18 would be required to wear helmets. There's educational pieces to the bill, too, that talk about how we need to get information not only out to the people who are riding the scooters, but also to people who are driving cars in terms of what the regulations are and what can actually.
And then 18 and above, they would be legal on streets under the current.
They would be legal on streets.
Yeah.
I mean, because it is true that, you know, for example, in Pittsburgh, we've had they've had a pilot program for the last couple of years where they were sort of doing the share program with scooters, but they're all geared towards the last mile kind of thing where people can't get to on public transportation, but still need to, you know, be able to access their homes. And it's been an interesting, it's been an interesting process, and we're trying to expand that a little further. But I think if folks have been to Washington, D.C., for example, and seen all the, you know, they have several different scooter share programs there. There's no docking system for them. They just, people use them and leave them, and they they are sort of all over the place. And so I think when we first got involved with this, we were really about 3 years ago, we were talking about the docking systems and how those kind of work in order to try to, yeah, you know, clean streets up. But it is a fundamentally good way to transport people, but that we need people to do it safely. We need to make sure that people know what they're dealing with, and because it's one little piece of metal between you and the road, right?
Yeah. And as we get ready to wrap up, Senator Carney, I mean, what does the, you know, coalition in Harrisburg look like? Is this a bill that is likely to become law?
Oh, I believe so, yes. I mean, horrendous things like this happen. They do have, you know, sort of galvanizing effects that literally, you know, bring people together around things. And what we're talking about is not, you know, it's really kind of common sense stuff. I mean, whether you ban them for underage drivers, I think, you know, for riders, you know, these things can often go, yeah, 25, 30 miles an hour. And that's fast. I mean, our bill would limit the speed to 20. But we've seen some of these rideshare scooters that are kept at, 10 miles an hour or 15 miles an hour, depending on where they're used and in what context.
Well, that is Senator Tim Carney from Delaware County. Thanks so much for your time today, Senator.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Jesse Amadio, wanted to get your thoughts on Abby's Law and generally how you think e-scooters should be regulated here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, thank you. I think that, like, this law, I love that it is actually giving these scooters some distinction in our traffic code. Mm-hmm. Because we, as the senator said, like, it's a really critical way to move people around. This is a great solution. It just has some other, like, loose ends logistics that we need to figure out how to make function correctly in our city. But I always caution, especially the laws that I hear where people are banning the scooters and things, or, you know, even the helmets. Helmets are a great idea, but it really comes down to the speed of the car that hits the person who is not in a car that is going to make the biggest difference here. And so, you know, if you're riding a scooter or a bike, you're what they consider a vulnerable user, because mm-hmm. there isn't a 2-ton metal cage around you. And even if you're following all the rules, you're wearing a helmet, if you are hit by a car that's going 40 miles an hour, there is a 90% chance that you will die whether you're wearing a helmet or not. And so I think, like, common sense, you know, safety education, super important. That's definitely a part of it. But when our roads are still designed in such a way that cars are able to drive 40 miles an hour right beside someone on a bike or someone on a scooter, crashes that, like the ones that killed Abby and other, like Harry Fenton last week, like, they will just keep happening.
Yeah. I want to read this comment from Bros a Fan on Facebook, who says, it would be great to have a public service campaign to educate drivers on how to share the road. That said, I often see bikers in the burbs who don't follow the traffic rules, not stopping at stop signs. I want to bring in a caller. We have Ben from Mount Airy on the line. Ben, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I think that an overlooked factor really is driver behavior, and especially as regards distracted driving, people are always on their phones. I want to know if there's a bigger role that the police department can play in making sure that people follow the law, put down their phones, and drive safer. That's my question.
Thank you so much, Ben from Mount Airy. You know, any comment on this, Jesse, Alex, on this? I know there's the law that actually, we talked about this on the show, the law went into effect. You cannot, use your phones at all and drive. It's illegal. So your thoughts, Jesse?
Yeah. So this question has a very Philly answer, I think, which is that we have seen a major decrease in police traffic stops for the last couple of years. And they probably could be doing more to address the aggressive driving that we've been seeing on the roads. Philly Bike Action takes the position that enforcement is inconsistent in our city, and that other methods, specifically physical infrastructure, is the best way to...
You would focus more on those changes over enforcement, is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. Because if you build a street in a way that makes distracted driving or physical or reckless driving impossible, or slows down a crash that's about to happen, you can protect people 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whereas if you're relying on traffic stops or retroactive justice, it doesn't really save anybody's life. So do I think that we could be doing more to enforce stuff in the city? Yes. But failing that, I think we need to just start building around our reality, which is that we need to help control behavior through our built environment.
Alex, what do you see as the role of enforcement in all this? We talked about the Philly, the PPD there, but there's also the PPA, which is enforcing whether or not you're blocking the bike lane, in a loading zone, et cetera, et cetera. What do you see as the role and limits of enforcement?
So from as an injury epidemiologist, I'll say that, you know, three of the E's that we traditionally use for thinking about preventing injuries are education, enforcement, and engineering, which, you know, engineering refers to the infrastructure aspect. And typically, engineering is the most effective long-term solution, but enforcement does have a role. You know, in terms of the driver behaviors, things like that, I think, as Jesse mentioned, you know, it can be applied very unequally. And so that can cause a lot of problems, you know, in terms of like who's getting stopped, you know, for what reason and why they're getting stopped.
But you got these cameras now that can do
can do it. Exactly. Automated enforcement. So I lived in Bogota for a few years before I just came back here a few weeks ago. And they had automated enforcement of cell phone use. So they have cameras that would detect if someone had their phone in their hand. And they'd send them a ticket to that, you know, wherever that car was registered.
Wow. Yeah.
So I think, you know,
that's Colombia, by the way.
Yeah, in Colombia. Uh-huh.
Some people, I think, are worried, though, about too much AI, too much camera, privacy stuff. Jesse, what do you say to folks who might, because there's a like a pilot program here where the Septage buses are equipped with cameras that have supposedly AI integrated into them and can automatically issue tickets to people blocking lanes. I mean, do you worry about that? Are you in favor of that? What do you make of it?
So, I mean, personally, I'm always a little skeptical of AI, I'll say that. But the Septibus cameras, it's not using a kind of, it's not like videotaping the streets and learning from it as it drives. They have like models that are trained on like license plates and stuff. And then it gets like put on a bus and it's very low. It's like very low energy usage. And it's just kind of analyzing it based on what it's already been trained on. And I do think maybe the ship has sailed on our surveillance, like we're all carrying around our surveillance devices in our pocket. So, you know, I personally feel like the benefits to automated enforcement in the fact that they are proven and they are actively saving lives in Philly right now, make them like a valid use of that technology. For example, Roosevelt Boulevard, which was the first road in Philly to get that automated speed enforcement. There's the deadliest road in Philadelphia. And just by installing those cameras in a year, the speeding, like amount of speeding over the speed limit went down like 100%. And they estimate that one life a month has been saved in the reduction of speeding on that.
Yeah, and as a reporter, I used to cover a lot of vigils on Roosevelt Boulevard. I want to bring in another caller that can maybe tee up our conversation for the other side of the break that's coming. We have Steve from Chestnut Hill on the line. Steve, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is initially about Philadelphia needs to look outwardly around the world. Cities that are much older than Philadelphia have solved this problem. And so we shouldn't just all gather in a conference room in Philly and think we're going to solve it. We need to look around the world at places where they have actually solved these problems. And in other dimensions, I want to give a shout out to the issue of public awareness and regulations. I mean, you know, even bicyclists don't follow all the regulations. It's too easy, and it's too easy to get a driver's license without having awareness of various regulations related to these issues. So it's a multidimensional thing. But mostly, I wish that Philadelphia would start looking outwardly to solutions.
All right. Well, thank you, Steve from Chestnut Hill. We will look outwardly on the other side of this break. Start brainstorming, Alex. We want some suggestions, okay?
You're
listening
you're the guy
to Studio 2 on WHYY. We are asking you this hour. In a time when e-bikes, scooters, bikes, pedestrians, and cars share the streets, how do we create a safer city? Keep those calls coming, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. And And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We are talking about the new reality on our roads and sidewalks where motorized vehicles must share space with pedestrians and cyclists. And we are exploring how to make our city streets accessible and safe for everyone. Our question of the day to you, our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere is this: in a time when e-bikes, scooters, bikes, pedestrians, and cars share the streets, how can we create a safer city? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, drop your comments in the chat.
Our guests this hour are Jesse Amadio, organizer at Philly Bike Action, and Alex Quistberg, associate research professor at Drexel University. And Alex, our caller before the break, asked, what can we learn from other cities? So what can we learn, Alex?
I mean, there's, like I mentioned earlier, so much out there that other cities are doing and dealing with the same issues that we are. And, you know, innovation is everywhere. You know, there's, you know, Paris is a great example of that has increased bike usage substantially in the past decade, you know, by closing roads down to certain types of vehicles or reducing parking so that it's harder to, you know, it's de-incentivizing driving. And people have opened up to this and switched to bicycling in a lot of cases. Where I was in Bogota, I mean, there's over, you know, almost 1 million bike trips a day there, you know, and they have open streets every Sunday and every holiday, closed down 130 kilometers, you know, about 80 miles of roadways, major roadways every Sunday and holiday to let people out and do biking and exercising, things like that. So I think there's a lot we can learn from other cities. If we think about, like, what do we want to do for our city? What do we want out of our transportation system? Like, how can we make our transportation work for us while also improving our health, wellness, you know, mental, you know, sanity and everything like that? Yeah. You know, I think that's what we want to think about.
Well, it seems a lot of it comes down to cars and how to get people A, out of them, or B, make them operate those cars more slowly. But obviously you're going to get a lot of pushback there. And I also wonder also about, you know, the other thing that's changed over the last 20 years is our reliance on delivery services. These delivery vehicles take up a lot of space, but people really do rely on them for all sorts of goods and services. How do you design a city that is bike friendly, but still economically viable?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a number of studies on this as well. And, you know, in general, installing like bike lanes or protected bike lanes is good, is a good benefit economically for businesses along those bike lanes, because you get more people on the street, more opportunity for people to use those stores and things like that. You know, creates more access to those things for everybody. You know, in terms of like traffic and congestion in general, like reducing the number of lanes on roads typically actually makes the roads more efficient. And even though you might have higher volumes, people are going at like a more steady speed. And so that enables, you know, less congestion. People can get to their destination faster if you are driving. So these things aren't necessarily a negative thing for, you know, for drivers, you know, or people that have to rely on a motor vehicle. And if you get more of this infrastructure, more encouragement for cycling or public transit or walking or other modes, I mean, you get less people in cars. And that's what we, you know, that will really help actually with congestion and speeding and all those things if we can focus on those, you know, making those changes. So there's things like that we can think about, like how we can make space, you know, accommodating deliveries. Some cities are converting to, you know, like the bicycling or smaller vehicles for deliveries instead of taking up, you know, the whole big traditional truck or van. You know, so there's things like that we can look at, you know, and think about what do we want, you know, for our city? Like, how do we want to move around, you know? You know, something we can even consider, like New York is congestion pricing, you know. That might be something to think about, you know, for reducing that center city, you know, traffic jams.
Yeah. I want to read a couple comments. Citizen Dave says, I think the majority of bike accidents are because people aren't paying attention and bike riders feel so entitled that a car will not hit them and thus make unwise moves. Bikes and e-scooters are secondary and should be treated as such. That's Citizen Dave. He says, we cannot build unlimited safety measures because of stupidity. MJ says, remind people, whether they are drivers, pedestrians, people on scooters, bikes, e-bikes, etc., that we have to share public spaces. We have to be mindful and alert. We all depend on each other. I want to bring in another caller. We have Ron from Society Hill on the line. Ron, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I am a cyclist. I'm a motorist. I'm a pedestrian. And I'm a resident on a street in Society Hill where there is a bike lane. And I'm sorry if this was brought up earlier in your show, but I did not catch it. There's been a lot of conflict in our area now about protected bike lanes on Pine Street and Spruce Street through the historic area. And oftentimes it's brought up that unfortunately we had two fatalities in the area over the last number of years, neither of which would have been saved by a protective bike lane. One death occurred at an intersection, another one with a drunk driver. So there's really nothing in terms of infrastructure that would have prevented either of those. But there are so many cyclists who just disobey the law. They come flying through the intersection without looking to see if there's a car coming, for one. I do that as a pedestrian, even if I have a green light. Yeah. That they don't talk about making themselves more visible. One of the fatalities may have been prevented if the cyclist was more visible. They don't talk about wearing helmets. They don't talk about wearing strobe lights that are very inexpensive to put on helmets. I have one. They don't talk about reflectors on bicycles.
Yeah,
they
thanks, Ron. And Ron,
we're going to wrap it there because we have to get some response here. So, Jesse, I know you would disagree with a lot of what Ron said, and I just want you to make the counter case here.
Yeah, I find it interesting that he thinks that because the driver is drunk, nothing would have saved her, but maybe if she was wearing a high-vis vest, she would have been saved. We know for a fact, there's video of the crash that he was talking about is Dr. Barbara Fetus last summer. The driver of the car was trying to pass another car in the car lane and merged into the unprotected bike lane, accelerated, drove over 8 flexible posts, and then rear-ended the person on the bike. And sorry, I'm just a little worked up.
No, that was a tragic accident. And
respond to, because you must hear from folks like Ron all the time, and I know it's difficult, like, is there, when people bring up the behavior of cyclists in this whole equation, what do you tell them in response?
Yeah. If we look at the last 3 people who died in our city while riding a bike, they were following the rules. They were biking in the right place. They were wearing a helmet. They were doing crossing on a green. You know, they were doing the right things. And they were killed by drivers who were doing the wrong thing, operating a vehicle far, far heavier and more deadly than the vehicle that they were riding on.
And so what do you want to, how do we get to this place? Because there's going to be so many vehicles. We all have to share the road. Everybody has to look out for each other and for themselves. What do you see the solution as? Because some people do say that there are some cyclists, and maybe not the ones in these cases, that have broken the rules, that did not do everything they could. Is there a way that we could all come together and make sure we at least try to save more lives?
Yeah, obviously everybody who's in public space needs to be aware of their surroundings and operating courteously to their fellow neighbors. That's regardless of what you're doing on our public streets. But I think that, you know, there's a hierarchy of risk and a hierarchy of danger. And of the 120 people last year and the year before that and the year before that in Philadelphia who have died on our roads, all of them were killed by people driving cars. No one was killed by a bicycle. This includes serious injury. I mean, you can obviously get hurt, but we have to look at, like, if you were operating the deadly vehicle, you have the most responsibility. And then, because we don't look at pedestrians and say, like,
you're saying unsafe behavior by a driver in a car and unsafe behavior by a cyclist
are two different things.
They have different consequences.
Also consider visibility. You might think that a person riding a bike isn't looking. And of course, I'm sure there are people out there that are doing crazy stuff, just like there are drivers out there doing crazy stuff. But the vast majority of people riding bikes, it may seem like they're not looking, but we have far greater visibility than you have when you're in a car. We can see, basically 300, degrees. And we have just like a lot more maneuverability. If we're on one side of the road or the other, we can see a lot more than you think that we can see. And so also there's like Idaho stops are legal in a lot of states or in some states where that just means like there's actually evidence that if a bicyclist uses a stop sign as a yield sign, they can get ahead of cars behind them, create more safe distance. And there's actually safety benefits to allowing a cyclist to use the stop sign as a yield sign.
On all this, let me bring in a couple comments that I think are on your points, Jesse. Tom in Center City says, drivers in Philly are unbelievably careless. I feel like I have to swivel my head like an owl every time I cross the street. And this is an interesting comment from Chris. Chris says, motorists should not be the default commuters in our city. We need more bike lanes and strict laws on the books to protect them. We also need to lobby our state legislature to fund SEPTA and our local government to figure out ways to restore our public transit system. And that idea of motorists, Alex, as the default commuters mm-hmm. in a city, is that how it is everywhere around the world? And what would that look like, mm-hmm. a world where there was maybe at least an equivalency in terms of priority mm-hmm. when it came to bikes, yeah. cyclists, and bikes, cars, and everyone else? What could that world look like? And is that the world we should be driving
yeah.
toward?
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah, I mean, here in the U.S., we have like 9 vehicles per every 10 people. You know, we have like one of the most motorized, you know, nations in the world. You know, because we've led the car, you know, use across the world. You know, with the car companies in the 40s and 50s, and you know, spreading those out. But a lot of places have, like, Europe is like 6 per 10 people. Latin America, a lot of low and middle income countries are more like 2 or 3, you know, vehicles per 10 people or less. It gives a lot more opportunity for people to use public transit. Like in Bogota, so I'll go back to that example, like over 50% of the daily trips are in public transit, yeah. 25% are walking trips, less than 10% are in car or motorcycle, you know, so.
One thing you often yeah. hear in response is America's just really spread out.
It is.
And
it is.
So like we can't really model ourselves mm-hmm. after, I specifically people will say like yeah. European cities, right?
Yeah.
It would never work here. So I guess, do you think, mm-hmm. let's look at the geography of a place mm-hmm. like Philadelphia. Could we create a city mm-hmm. where people really just don't drive all that much?
Yeah.
You think that's possible?
I think it's possible. I mean, it's not something that we can do like, you know, next year or in 10 years even probably. But, you know, there's cities even in Europe that did this. Like Amsterdam is a great example people bring up all the time that had very similar like car use
yeah.
as we have in the U.S. currently back in the 60s. And then they started removing, you know, cars from vehicle, from the roadways, building bikeways, things like that. And even like closing off roads to cars, you know, to motorists. And so, you know, that created a different environment for transportation that we see today. So I think, you know, it creates, you know, we need to create a way for people to understand what it could look like, you know, and it's very hard because we have designed our cities, you know, and the areas around our cities to be very spread out because we want, you know, certain types of homes and things like that. And so that's made it, you know, more difficult maybe to accommodate all those desires with like getting and working yeah. in the city. So
one of the things that people sell Philadelphia on is its walkability. Mm-hmm. I don't ride bikes, but I like to walk and I like to walk miles. And Eric says no e-bikes in the bike lane or on the sidewalks. They are full motor vehicles and belong in the road just like a Vespa. I feel like those are always cutting off pedestrians and actual cyclists. Really happy to see more protected bike lanes in Philly. Just rode my bike to the dentist this morning from Fishtown to 17th and Locust. And so I want to talk about sharing the sidewalks because I walked outside. Like I said, I almost got hit by somebody on an e-scooter on the sidewalk. Mm-hmm. What are the rules of the sidewalk? And, you know, as we try to create a safer space for walkers as well, we just don't want to forget those folks.
Yeah.
And saving some space for them.
Absolutely.
Jessie.
Absolutely. I think like it's everybody is a pedestrian at some point, right? When you
yeah.
get off your bike, when you get out of the subway, when you get out of your car, everybody walks or is a pedestrian using a chair or something like that in our city at some point. And that is so important. And that's why, you know, I really believe that if we are building to keep the most vulnerable people safe, it benefits everybody. So if you're building an intersection, for example, where you want to decrease the car speed and you want to increase visibility, in my opinion, these are the two biggest things that you can do in any place that's going to make the experience of traveling in that space better for everybody. So you're a pedestrian, you are coming up to a corner, you can't see the intersection because there's cars parked up to the stop sign. You don't see that e-scooter coming, they don't see you, you know, and so there's this limited visibility at intersections, and if we could fix that, and they've been doing it all around the city now, putting out the extensions on the sidewalk to create what they call bump outs, it increases visibility for the pedestrians, it helps the cyclists crossing the street, it helps cars who are trying to make sharp turns or just see who's crossing the street when they're moving through the intersection. Like, this is a great example of infrastructure that benefits fundamentally the pedestrian, but like it ends up benefiting everybody else all the way to the driver.
And the bike lanes keep all the motorized vehicles off the sidewalk so people on sidewalks can actually walk.
Exactly. There's tons of studies that show that if you have dedicated bicycle infrastructure, people will use them. So the sidewalk riding goes down when you install a good bike lane. Now, people might see a bike lane that's just like a dashed painted line like they have on West Passyunk and think, oh, and now I see a biker on the sidewalk. They're probably on the sidewalk because that 3-foot dash painted door zone bike lane on a high speed road isn't safe enough for their comfort. So that's where we really talk about high quality protected bike lanes, because if the bike lane isn't perceived to be safe enough, it doesn't match the level of danger that's on the kind of road that it's on, which will be different from like an arterial to a neighborhood street. People will choose the option that feels the most comfortable to them. And of course, we would prefer that our streets were designed so that people who are, you know, walkers being the most vulnerable, they should have some nice space for themselves. And then other people moving at speed can be in the streets. But again, I come back to that thing. Everybody, especially if we're talking about like a center city or like the neighborhood streets, 20 miles an hour. Like if you get hit by a car at 20 miles an hour, there's only a 10% chance that it will be fatal. And that's why it's important, I think, for the e-scooters and the e-bikes and everything.
So that's your target, sort of everyone moving at that speed and below.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, obviously this will be different on highways, but that's when you would implement a totally separate, totally protected cycle track.
In a place as dense as Center City, that would be your target, 20.
Exactly. And
20 is plenty.
20 is plenty, okay.
20 is plenty.
Good to end on a rhyme. Right. Thank you so much. Jesse Amadio, organizer at Philly Bike Action. Alex Quisberg, associate research professor at Drexel University. Thank you both for your time today on Studio 2.
Thank you.
Great, thank you.
So sorry we couldn't get to you, Greg from Chester County. Hopefully you'll call in next time on the show. Thank you so much to our producers, Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We will talk to you tomorrow.